Chapter 40. The crime scene at Marilyn's home, as noted, was a compromised disaster. Instead of immediately being closed off, even after Sergeant Clemens arrived, visitors who should have not been allowed there were permitted to parade across the floor space and touch objects of interest, destroying any semblance of accurate evidence collection. Such a collection would have been proper procedure in an ordinary house burglary, let alone in the death of the most famous actress in the world. There thus were not, as noted, any fingerprints lifted from any surface, including the bed area or bathroom, the collection of empty pill bottles, the doorknob, the broken window, or the telephone receiver Marilyn was clutching when she died all alone. Also, the bedsheets and the blanket, if there was one, should have been saved, but they had been removed from the bedroom before any police arrived, in violation of Standard Investigating Procedures 101. Similar to Kilgallen's case, the drug ingestion by Marilyn, if that is what happened, would have caused bradycardia. This must have triggered substantial pain for Marilyn, who had everything to gain in life based on the recent turn of events that caused her to look to the future and be in a good mood, a happy mood, as described by her close friend Pat Newcomb, despite the rumblings of hurt caused by Bobby Kennedy's mental abuse. All this said, specific insight into each of the potential causes of Marilyn's death provides some clarity. Again, if Kilgallen was on the job, it seems probable she would have listed the following as possible accounts for her friend's death. Suicide. Marilyn intentionally took her own life by ingesting close to 50 Nembutal pills. Standard accidental death. Marilyn, as had happened before, miscalculated how many pills to ingest and overdosed. Accidental death. Marilyn initially took the correct dosage of Nembutal, but then, being in a drowsy state, took more, causing her to overdose. Murder by injection by Dr. Engelberg or Dr. Greenson, under orders to do so, causing either the physician or the psychiatrist to deliberately administer a lethal dose of barbiturates under Marilyn's armpit, into her pubic area, or under her toes, causing death while hiding the needle marks, so coroner Thomas Noguchi did not record them when he performed the autopsy. Murder by injection by operatives hired by those threatened by Marilyn's promise to contact the media and hold a news conference detailing her love affairs with John and Robert Kennedy, as well as possible exposure of matters of national security, perhaps even JFK's belief in UFOs. Again, the needle marks would have been hidden. Murder by use of an enema packed with barbiturates by the same operatives as noted earlier. Murder by injection of air into Marilyn's pubic area by the same operatives as noted earlier. Murder by use of an enema or injection of air by either Dr. Engelberg or Dr. Greenson under orders to do so. Regarding the final three alternatives, each would prevent remnants of Nembutal being evident in Marilyn's stomach content as Noguchi recorded in the autopsy. Through Kilgallen's eyes, it seems likely she would have dismissed suicide since, as she had noted in her columns, Marilyn was enjoying the good life. Regarding accidental death, certainly it was more plausible than suicide and could actually have happened, especially accidental death, since Marilyn was known to make mistakes with proper dosage amounts. To understand how this type of death may have occurred, glimpse just one of the various prescriptions Dr. Engelberg wrote for her, this one on July 10, 1962, less than a month before she died. The four drugs include Valmid, Secanol, Tuinol, and Librium. In fact, this author discovered no less than 11 prescriptions Engelberg wrote for Marilyn, starting on June 6, 1962, and ending with four of them written on the 17th of July, less than 2 weeks before she died. Besides the three mentioned, others included Darvon, prescribed to treat mild to moderate pain, and Percodan. In effect, Engelberg was Marilyn's drug dealer, intent on stuffing her body with as many pills as possible. Regarding the alternative methods of murder, Kilgallen, ever the savvy investigative reporter, would have examined each one based on the full slate of the homicide detective's best friend's motive, means, opportunity, and benefit from the crime. Recalling the questions that she had posed about Marilyn in the Voice of Broadway, Martha Proves She's a Trooper column, Kilgallen would have weighed the merits of each while listing suspects who had reason to cause Marilyn harm, to shut her up as those enemies of Kilgallen's did when she died. As mentioned before, the famous journalist was always on the lookout for the tiniest of clues that could solve a murder. Recall that it had appeared to Sergeant Clemens that Marilyn's legs were stretched out perfectly straight, unlike the contorted bodies of most victims who overdosed on sleeping pills, either accidentally or on purpose. Predictably, Kilgallen would have been as suspicious as Clemens was that the death scene had been staged. A continuing mystery is the absence of the needle marks on Marilyn's body, since on the invoice submitted by Dr. Engelberg to the Superior Court following Marilyn's death, numerous injections were noted, including one apparently connected to a residence call on August 3, 1962, the day before Marilyn died. The invoice reads, "Since it is obvious that these injections were administered, 13 of them from the 2nd of July through the day before Marilyn passed, Noguchi's report that he found no evidence of any injections again tarnishes his performance as a deputy medical examiner. Some of the injection marks would have been fresher than others, but the ones given on August 3rd would have, it seems, been apparent. Also, there is no indication of what drugs were administered by Dr. Engelberg. Since there were no visible marks, and, according to Noguchi, no other evidence of physical harm having come to Marilyn other than the dark reddish-blue bruise on her left hip, one, judging by its color, fresh rather than old, as Noguchi noted, the killers, if this was a homicide, were home free. No charges were possible, probably even if there had been any semblance of an investigation about cause of death, which never happened since LAPD Chief William Parker stopped any real probe in its tracks." Certainly, Noguchi did not dispute Dr. Kerfee adding the word probable to suicide, nor did anyone else of authority. The deputy medical examiner apparently did not have a clue, or, if he did, kept silent about it for fear, it would seem, of being reprimanded by his boss. With all of this in mind, Dr. Cyril Wecht, still as sharp at age 89 as he had been earlier in his distinguished career, attempted to fill in the blanks as to the cause of Marilyn's death during an interview with this author in mid-2020. Shown the abbreviated autopsy report, he concluded that the word probable was, in all likelihood, added to suicide because medical examiner Ted Kerfee, as noted, wasn't happy with the suicide verdict. Wecht suspected that Kerfee was convinced by higher-ups that the conclusion needed to be suicide, but the ME, on his own, added the word probable since he was unsure of the exact cause of death. By capitulating in this compromise, the official version became probable suicide, which Wecht insisted was the first and last time he ever saw that verdict during a long and illustrious career that has included his participation in such high-profile cases as not only the JFK and RFK assassinations, but also JonBenet Ramsey, Sharon Tate, Daniel and Anna Nicole Smith, Vincent Foster, and Sonny Von Bulow. Dr. Wecht told this author, "At one point, I bounced the case around with Tom Noguchi, reviewed it with him. He said that at the time he was going to check the contents of the first 6 inches of the small intestine and then the second 6 inches to see if there were different levels of barbiturates. This would have meant," Wecht said, "that the deceased, in this case Marilyn, may have become confused after taking a proper dose of barbiturates and then taken a second amount, the accidental cause of death noted before." Wecht said that, "Normally, granular material, pellets of the barbs, would have been present in both sections of the small intestine, and that was what Noguchi was looking for. But after he forgot to test that internal organ, as the deputy medical examiner admitted, when he went back to find those organs, they had been destroyed. This made it impossible to know if the accidental death may have occurred, which could have substantiated the decision in Marilyn's case report by Dr. Noguchi on August 8th, where he initially surmised that she had died, it may be recalled, from a Barb's overdose with no suggestion of suicide. Regarding the potential that an enema may have been given to Marilyn, that the barbiturates could have been fed into her system that way, or that they may have been injected into her pubic area, or another area of the body where the needle marks were hidden, Wecht said, "I don't preclude it, but it's hard to believe." This meant, he added, that I can't completely discount homicide, but more than likely I believe she died by taking a second dose of the sleeping pills after she took the first one. Unfortunately for justice's sake, Noguchi's mistakes made it impossible to know for sure, making the accounts of the alternative methods by which she died offered by Gianni Russo, Marilyn was given an injection of air through her pubic area, hiding any needle marks, and Joe DiCarlo, enema, no needle marks, plausible. This said, at the very least, the verdict as to how Marilyn died must be changed from probable suicide to accidental death, with the potential for foul play. When Dr. Wecht was asked by this author about Robert Kennedy's possible involvement in Marilyn's death, and was told that positive proof exists destroying RFK's alibi that he was near San Francisco on the day Marilyn died, Wecht said that, although he could not agree with certainty, if word came down to Dr. Kerfee or others associated with her case that this needed to be a suicide, especially from the effing attorney general or the president, that was that. Wecht added, Kerfee then would have hid behind the verdict of probable suicide. This would have covered up the truth about what happened to her, one instance of many occurring when she died. The others, Wecht spoke of, certainly could have included LAPD Chief William Parker, under orders from the big shots in Washington, J. Edgar Hoover and the Kennedys, specifically Bobby. Regarding Parker and Hoover, in a revealing article, University of Southern California professor John T. Donovan wrote, "The relationship between Hoover and Parker was strained in the 16 years that Parker served as chief of police." No surprise there, since both men were tattooed with huge egos, with Donovan revealing that a Los Angeles judge said of Parker, "He has evidently set himself up as God's gift to law enforcement." Hoover is quoted in the article as saying, "I have no use for this fellow Parker, and we should keep our guard up in all of our dealings with him," cementing the distrust between the two rivals. Concerning Parker's connection to the Kennedys, Donovan wrote that the chief was a personal friend of the Kennedys. Donovan added that Bobby Kennedy continued to consider Parker the best police chief in the nation. J. Edgar Hoover's continuing to have his eye on Dorothy Kilgallen, which had ensued when she investigated JFK's death, recall his having written "Wrong, Wrong" on one of her columns, is proven on December 8, 1963, 16 days after JFK died, while bringing Robert Kennedy into the mix. This happened after Frank Sinatra Jr., the famous crooner's 19-year-old son, was kidnapped from his room at Harrah's in Lake Tahoe. A huge ransom was demanded, and Father Frank acquiesced by paying nearly $250,000, $2 million in today's currency. Frank Jr. was released 2 days later. How do we know of Hoover's interest in the famous reporter? Because as the drama had unfolded, Kilgallen wrote a column in the New York Journal American under the banner Broadway Bulletin Board. To the left of the column, secured by this author under the Freedom of Information Act, Hoover, again in his own handwriting, wrote, "What a yarn." Most importantly, the column indicates the rub existing between Hoover and Parker, with Sinatra Sr. and RFK thrown into the feud. Kilgallen wrote, William H. Parker, chief of police of Los Angeles, made it clear to newspapermen that he was angry because the FBI had not informed him about the developments in the kidnapping of Frank Sinatra Jr. Parker was frank in saying that all he knew about the crime was what he read in the papers and saw on television. Chief Parker shouldn't blame J. Edgar Hoover, who has the highest regard for his ability as a sleuth. The whole case was taken out of Mr. Hoover's hands when Attorney General Robert Kennedy spoke on the telephone to Frank Sinatra Sr. and offered him the facilities of the Federal Bureau of Investigation. From that moment on, the elder Sinatra was in charge of the FBI, and he directed all of the movements in the apprehension of the culprits. In addition, Kilgallen had written another column about the case. Exhibiting her prowess as an investigative reporter, Kilgallen asked more than a few questions about the kidnapping of Frank Jr. Included among them were how many different kidnapper voices Sinatra had spoken to on the telephone, what made Sinatra figure there were 7 to 9 kidnappers involved in the plot, and was there a good theory as to why Frank Jr. was able to talk one of the kidnappers into releasing him before the others got back with the ransom money. Sinatra must have been incensed at Kilgallen's audacity to ask such questions. Research indicates any answers he provided were never printed in an additional column. While Kilgallen indicates in the first column that Chief Parker may have fumed about being left out of the loop regarding Sinatra Jr.'s case, common sense thus dictates that if RFK called Parker and suggested/ordered him to do everything possible to make certain that Marilyn's death was designated as a suicide, that was a done deal based on Bobby's power base. To that end, Parker, it would appear, deftly decided to appoint his psychiatric panels of experts. Dr. Wecht said Kerfey invented this type of autopsy to delve into Marilyn's past, with the verdict mentioned that she was a loose cannon psychologically and prone to suicide. End of story, with Parker having already influenced medical examiner Kerfey for the required result. Kerfey then distanced himself from the autopsy report by appointing Dr. Noguchi to handle it, and the web of deception crawled into the probable suicide announcement discussed before. Dr. Wecht compared what happened in Marilyn's case to that occurring when Kilgallen died, stating that if Dr. Helpern, the New York medical examiner, received the same sort of order that Dr. Kerfey received, then the addition of circumstances undetermined to the cause of Kilgallen's death was Helpern's hiding behind that wording. In each case, Wecht was surprised but not surprised that neither Kerfey nor Helpern handled the high-profile cases and instead handed them off to deputy/junior medical examiners Dr. Noguchi and Dr. James Luke, since that way Kerfey and Helpern still got the publicity but could pass off any criticisms to the younger junior MEs. In Kilgallen's case, the word from above may have very well come from those who were mob-connected in the Manhattan ME's office, as described, it may be recalled, by toxicologists John Broich and Stephen Goldner. The result was the international disclosure to the media that she had died accidentally, when that had been an outright lie. Wecht, when told that both probable suicide in Marilyn's case and accidental death in Kilgallen's case, each a distortion of history, had resulted in headlines such as Marilyn Kills Herself and Kilgallen Dead of Drug Overdose, the revered forensic scientist seemed dismayed. Regarding Dr. Noguchi, while they had been friends at one time, Wecht called him cowardly for not speaking up about the discrepancies later on regarding the Robert Kennedy death concerning the range of shots that killed the presidential candidate. Wecht told this author, "Noguchi's remaining silent was disturbing, and I tried several times to get him to come forward with the facts, but he would not do so." Without question, an expert like Dr. Wecht's opinions about Marilyn's cause of death should be taken quite seriously, since his ability to recollect is top-notch and may thus be relied upon. He is a man of the truth, but even with all of his experience in handling the forensics involved with high-profile murder cases, he cannot with certainty proclaim a final verdict for how Marilyn died, since he did not take part in the forensic matters following her death. One must therefore take what he says and then evaluate it along with all of the non-forensic evidence so as to determine what actually happened during the evening hours and by whom when Marilyn passed from this earth to her next destination. This said, a contrary viewpoint to the potential cause of death, separate from Dr. Wecht's and the ones expressed by Gianni Russo and Joe DiCarlo, each of which is certainly a worthy account, may also be considered, one which is arguably more logical in nature regarding Marilyn's death. It deals with three credible aspects of known evidence about what happened: the presence of chloral hydrate and nembutal in her system, housekeeper Eunice Murray seen doing laundry in the middle of the night after the movie star died, and a heretofore ignored physical mark on Marilyn's body revealed in Noguchi's autopsy. Of the three, it is especially the presence of chloral hydrate that may be the missing clue, perhaps even what may be called a smoking gun, that is the key to providing the most plausible explanation as to how Marilyn died, and it certainly was not by suicide or probable suicide. If those threatened by Marilyn's possible exposures to the media, which could have included her love affairs with the Kennedys, her knowledge of national security secrets she learned from them, of her having knowledge that the Kennedys fixed the 1960 election, had decided a clandestine operation was necessary to eliminate her, the following scenario may be evaluated based on this author being guided by what Kilgallen may likely have concluded had she further investigated Marilyn's death. This seems fair to do based on gathering all of the information she had accumulated, as noted in her columns, plus everything she said about her friend's death to those she confided in, including her butler James Clement. With this in mind, to begin a chronicle of what most likely may have happened to Marilyn through Dorothy's eyes, at some point close to midnight, Marilyn, unable to sleep, heard a noise by her front door. When she opened it, she was immediately confronted by two men and then stunned when a chloroform-sealed cloth was stuffed over her nose and mouth. Marilyn may have attempted to scream, but to no avail. Next up, the two men recruited to end Marilyn's life either dragged or carried her into the bedroom, which was not locked, removed any outer clothing she was wearing, such as a robe and panties, and then carefully positioned her nude body on the floor face down. One man, after turning on the light, then locked the door to make sure they were not disturbed. While moving the body into the bedroom, the perpetrators inadvertently caused Marilyn's lower body to hit a hard object along the way, such as a sturdy piece of furniture, or either the edge of the open bedroom door or the doorknob. Obviously, other explanations exist as to how Marilyn could have bruised her left hip. But if it did happen as suggested, arguably an indication of foul play, then the second of the three credible aspects of known evidence, the dark reddish-blue bruise on Marilyn's left hip, one, judging by its color, fresh rather than old, as Noguchi noted in his autopsy, but without offering an explanation as to what caused the bruise, may in fact be explained. Of specific interest is Noguchi writing fresh rather than old, meaning that the injury could have happened when Marilyn's body was being moved, adding to the plausibility of the operatives readying the movie star for the kill. The bruise is thus significant and would be even more so if Noguchi had elaborated on what he meant by it being fresh. But at the least, there is a plausible explanation for the presence of the bruise on her left hip, since, to date, this author has not discovered any research pointing to another cause. Since chloral hydrate and nembutal were discovered in Marilyn's system during Dr. Thomas Noguchi's autopsy, recall blood tests revealed 8% of chloral hydrate, while the liver tests revealed 13% of pentobarbital, that is, nembutal, each a fatal dose, a combination of those drugs with water secured from the bedroom faucet were mixed. Concerning the chloral hydrate, which was first synthesized in 1932 by a chemist in Germany and may be administered without the need for injection, it is important to realize that it is rapidly absorbed through the gastrointestinal tract into the cardiovascular system and undergoes metabolic degradation in the liver and kidneys into its active form. Given the small therapeutic margin for error regarding these substances, the perpetrators would have mixed in enough of the chloral hydrate and nembutal to provide a lethal dose. Regardless, with Marilyn face down on the floor, the two men then dipped a bulb syringe of some sort into a mixed solution of the chloral hydrate and nembutal and inserted the tip into Marilyn's rectum, with some spillage possible. Quickly, the lethal dose would have infiltrated her blood system and begun the march to her death. Author's note: recall that Marilyn's autopsy indicated that the lower part of her colon showed purplish discoloration, an indication an enema could have been performed. Arguably, insertion of the dipped bulb syringe may have had the same effect. After lifting and then placing Marilyn's nude body face down on the bed and positioning the phone receiver, lying nearby, in her hand for effect, the two killers cleaned up as best they could and, forgetting to turn off the light, quietly left the home through the bedroom door, still wearing gloves, thus no fingerprints. Common sense appears to indicate that the men would have locked the door from the inside on the way out, which is consistent with Eunice Murray's statement that the door was locked before she called either Greenson or Engelberg. Suffice to say that if this proposed scenario happened, no needle marks would have been noticeable on Marilyn's body by Dr. Noguchi during the autopsy. Thus, Dwight Manley's account of what Joe DiCarlo told him: they sent people there, had it handled, no needles, anal. Asked for further details, Manley told this author, "I specifically asked about an enema of drugs, and Joe said yes," gains credibility. To be certain, Marilyn had certainly been handled through an anal insertion of the drugs. This said, the perpetrators made at least two mistakes. First, they left no glass on the nightstand to indicate Marilyn had taken any pills with water. And second, they did not consider that, while other options exist, some liquid could have oozed out of Marilyn's rectum onto the sheets. Proof that the latter could have happened provides, as Kilgallen would have realized, a plausible reason the third credible aspect of known evidence about what occurred makes sense. Why housekeeper Murray was doing laundry when Sergeant Clemens arrived at Marilyn's home. Other than the possibility that Marilyn had vomited, if, in fact, she had ingested barbiturates, which has been discounted, what other explanation can there be for Murray doing laundry, other than to wash the sheets which could have been smeared with the discharge from Marilyn's rectum, whether it was from the nembutal and chloral hydrate rectal intake or due to other substances being discharged when Marilyn died? It also accounts for Murray being pegged as an evasive witness by Sergeant Clemens, since she had destroyed evidence and become part of a cover-up. Of course, as with any theory like this, based on circumstantial evidence after so many years have passed, questions will be asked, with answers unfortunately somewhat speculative in nature. They include, what time did the intruders arrive? Murray said she saw the light under Marilyn's door at 12 o'clock p.m. before she went to bed, woke up at 3 o'clock a.m. and checked on Marilyn. Thus, about 3 hours had gone by, plenty of time for intruders to act. Where was Murray when the killers were in Marilyn's bedroom? Did Murray have knowledge of the attempt on Marilyn's life? Impossible to know. Recall that Kilgallen wrote in the column entitled "Martha Proves She's a Trooper" all of her questions about Marilyn's case. If Marilyn was accustomed to taking barbiturates to put her to sleep, it's quite possible that she could have slept through an explosion. Wasn't there some other reason why Mrs. Murray decided to call the doctor? Several explanations are possible as to what the other reason may be, including Murray having been spooked by hearing noise near Marilyn's bedroom, causing Murray to wonder if Marilyn was in distress and decide to call either Greenson or Engelberg. This explanation makes better sense than Murray stating that she saw light under Marilyn's door when she passed by, which appears to have been bogus for the reasons noted. In addition, Kilgallen's suspicions as to why the bedroom was such a mess had merit. Recall, she asked in a column, if the woman described as Marilyn's housekeeper is really a housekeeper, why was Marilyn's bedroom such a mess? It was a small house and should have been easy to keep tidy. But the reason the bedroom was in such disarray was because the intruders had not only hurriedly moved her body around to where she was found face down, but also, it appears likely, quickly searched for any of Marilyn's belongings. These included the mysterious diary, notebooks, audio tapes, and so forth, without concern for tidying things up before they left. Regarding time of death, recall that Dr. Engelberg, according to author Frank Capel, allegedly arrived at 3:50 a.m. Various time factors reported are as confusing as the cast of characters involved in Marilyn's life and her death. Capel wrote that Marilyn had been dead for at least 3 to 6 hours, which appears to be accurate, permitting the intruders to have poisoned her after Mrs. Murray went to bed, if she was telling the truth, around midnight. Speaking of Dr. Engelberg, whom, it may be recalled, was not invited by Joe DiMaggio to Marilyn's funeral, arguably because Joe knew the doctor was her drug dealer, so to speak, there appears to be a red herring that points to Engelberg's possible complicity in her death. Why? Because while the suggested scenario clears up the matter of how the chloral hydrate was present in Marilyn's system, Engelberg's statement to the Los Angeles Examiner, "I never gave Marilyn chloral hydrate, and I don't think any doctor in the United States gave it to her," is point-blank false. Why? Because this author was able to secure the copy of a prescription numbered 19293, dated 6762, and signed by H. Engelberg with the patient designation Marilyn Monroe for chloral hydrate. If Dorothy Kilgallen had further investigated Marilyn's death and believed the scenario presented here as to how she died was plausible, her first stop before searching for Engelberg's prescription history may very well have been Dr. Noguchi's report of chemical analysis from the toxicology laboratory, since chloral hydrate was listed among the drugs found in Marilyn's bedroom. Note that the drug had been refilled on 7/31/62, just a few days before Marilyn perished. But the most compelling question to ask is why Engelberg lied when he spoke to an Examiner reporter, especially since that reporter, if he had investigated at all, would have learned that the doctor was untruthful. And, as Kilgallen would have surmised, if Engelberg lied about the chloral hydrate, was it possible that he was complicit in her death, perhaps even through supplying Marilyn's perpetrators with the chloral hydrate used to kill her? Such observations about Marilyn's death provide stop-and-think, food-for-thought considerations as to how Marilyn met her maker and by whose actions. But the disaster state of the death scene, the confusing, less-than-truthful statements by Greenson and Engelberg and so forth, cloud the truth for certain. So while the finger of guilty for Marilyn's demise points squarely at Robert Kennedy having orchestrated her death via operatives sent to her home based on the plethora evidence in that direction, questions will always remain as to Drs. Greenson and Engelberg and their potential complicity. Regarding Greenson, recall that he was seen in L.A. in the front seat of the car being driven by Peter Lawford with Bobby in the back seat. And what about his statement, "Listen, talk to Bobby Kennedy," when discussing the cause of Marilyn's death, which appears to prove that he had some knowledge of RFK's part in the plan to kill Marilyn? Concerning Engelberg, his lies about the chloral hydrate matter cause one to wonder what else he was lying about regarding Marilyn's death. Could he, like Greenson, have been compromised into cooperating with plans to eliminate her? Certainly, both of them, as noted, benefited with the swift conclusion by the panel of psychiatrists that she had committed suicide, a conclusion neither doctor screamed or yelled about when it was rendered. Like Bobby Kennedy, Marilyn was washed away in Greenson's and Engelberg's minds as they moved on with their lives. Suffice it to say that evidence proving Marilyn did not commit suicide or die of an accidental overdose appears to be a given, since the nembutal/chloral hydrate mixture would have demanded intake through water and no glass was discovered by the death scene. This simple fact alone, Dorothy Kilgallen would have believed, results in the conclusion that her friend, the movie star, was murdered. What is known is that Marilyn never deserved to die as she did, naked to the world, permitting embarrassing photos of her dead body to be circulated from 1962 to present time that were absent the beauty she had displayed to the world for so many years. With this in mind, was Robert Kennedy responsible for Marilyn's death? Had RFK completed the circle of evil, first enveloping the movie star in a love affair that was doomed to failure, then encouraging her to continue it so he could play with her tantalizing body as others had done before under false pretenses and then discard her like a wet rag? If this occurred, and without question Bobby knew of Marilyn's precarious mental state, then he caused irreparable psychological damage before orchestrating her death by, through an intermediary, being responsible for the hiring of the operatives. As Attorney General, he certainly had the wherewithal to set up the kill, as Ron Paddicky did with Kilgallen's death. This could have happened in a number of ways, even with the help of J. Edgar Hoover, who would have gladly held Marilyn's death over his head to ensure that what Jackie Kennedy said in the book Jacqueline Kennedy, Historic Conversations on Life with John F. Kennedy, that if JFK had lived and won re-election in 1964, he was going to get rid of J. Edgar Hoover, never happened. Further, if the poisoning of Marilyn's body through the insertion of the deadly combination of chloral hydrate and nembutal killed her without any trace of needle marks, and Bobby had ordered this to happen, he certainly was at fault and would have faced charges on conspiracy to commit murder if his participation was exposed. Regardless, that mysterious death was covered up, and based on motive and benefit from the crime, it appears with much certainty by Robert Kennedy, who had the most to lose if Marilyn contacted the media about the specifics of their affair and/or the leaking of national security matters to her. Bottom line, just as Bobby Kennedy did not shoot his brother, the president, but JFK died because of RFK's abuse of power, Bobby may not have actually been an accomplice to the actual physical means by which Marilyn died, but by soliciting those who performed the deadly act, he was nevertheless responsible. Those who through the years have given Bobby a squeaky clean review by ignoring his philandering, a dark side tarnishing any of his accomplishments, appear to be quite mistaken. Marilyn was just one of a long line of those women he pursued in the ilk of his brother John. Regarding RFK's reputation with these women, the late Gwen Gibson, a Washington, D.C.-based New York Daily News reporter, told Larry Tye, author of the best-selling book Bobby Kennedy, The Making of a Liberal Icon, "He definitely had an eye for pretty women, like every Kennedy man. Like the father, RFK was a flirt." Regarding primary source accounts, John Anderson, an attorney in California who later worked on Bobby's presidential bid, reported seeing him smooching and nuzzling with actress Candace Bergen during a campaign flight. Of even more interest is Richard Goodwin, RFK's close friend, who, when asked about Bobby's straying from his marriage vows, stated, "Of course he did. That's a Kennedy family tradition. He wasn't sort of randomly random like his brother Jack, or Teddy, for that matter. Not at all. He was much more selective and limited." Selective RFK had chosen Marilyn, and within this context, the backdrop for deciding at whose hand she died must focus on him, and only him. Before Dorothy Kilgallen died, she told her attorney, Mort Farber, who had cautioned her to be quiet about her JFK assassination investigation research and conclusions, "I'm going to break the real story and have the biggest scoop of the century." In addition, Kilgallen was expecting photographers on the morning of her death in connection with a movie deal involving her book in progress for Random House. They were from 20th Century Fox Studios, the same studio Marilyn Monroe had dueled with before she died. It only stands to reason that Farber handled the legal aspects of any book or movie deals Kilgallen may have been offered. If such was the case, he would have had knowledge of the evidence she had compiled about the JFK assassination. Perhaps Farber even looked at her partial manuscript, the one Ron Paddocky mentioned and the one she showed to fellow What's My Line panelist and Random House publisher Bennett Cerf before her final appearance on the program. For the past few years, this author believed that Kilgallen's mention of the real story, the one the movie would be based on, pertained only to the JFK assassination. But further review, based on more research about Farber, prompts a reevaluation, leading to suspicions that the real story may have also included what happened to Marilyn when she died. Granting as much, Kilgallen might instead have used the plural stories, but this need not necessarily be the case, since she may have concluded that JFK's assassination was linked to those who she believed had also set up Marilyn for the kill. This would likely have included Robert Kennedy, based on Kilgallen having told her butler James Clement that it was the Kennedys who were responsible for Marilyn's demise. Who was Mort Farber? If Kilgallen confided in him regarding the real story or stories, what did she tell the attorney concerning the substance of her investigations into both Marilyn's death, logical, also based on her columns stating that the real story hadn't been told, and JFK's assassination? According to his 2009 obituary in the New York Times, Farber had received his undergraduate degree from Cornell in 1941 and his law degree from Yale University. He later founded the law firm of Farber, Cohen & Diamond, a leading entertainment and theatrical law firm based in New York City. He was the lawyer and/or manager to many well-known entertainers, including Tony Bennett, Johnny Mathis, Jerry Vale, and the Copacabana nightclub. Kilgallen wasn't mentioned, but Farber did in fact represent her, along with New York City mafia don Frank Costello, previously linked to Carlos Marcello, who was the behind-the-scenes owner of the Copa. That's the same Costello, as noted, whom Kilgallen had been friends with, perhaps acquaintances is a better word, the same Costello who, according to her hairdresser Mark Sinclair, gave her a diamond necklace during a lunch in Little Italy that she later transformed into diamond earrings. He was also the same Costello whom she had invited to the Science Club gathering of friends at P.J. Clark's. Costello's link to the Copacabana is certified by Gianni Russo in his book Hollywood Godfather. He recalled that as a runner for Costello, he would pick up envelopes, apparently stuffed with cash, and then drop them off with the maitre d' at the Copacabana on East 60th Street, the hottest club in New York. He then added that while a man named James Podell was the owner of record, Costello was the real owner. Regarding Costello's relationship with attorney Farber, Russo told this author during a March 2020 interview, "I was the eyes and ears for Mr. Costello. One of the first people I met in the 1950s was Mort Farber. He and Mr. Costello held court in the Copa Lounge most every night. I was always close at hand, but not part of the conversation." The Kilgallen-Costello-Farber connection causes one to wonder if Costello was one of the wrong people described by the Las Vegas casino boss that Ron Paddocky was compromised by, forcing him to leak Kilgallen's JFK assassination evidence, the trigger point for the famous reporter's death. It is also possible that Farber could have done so due to his allegiance to Costello as his attorney. Or perhaps Costello, who had first used Marcello's operation and muscle to further the New York Don's transporting illegal slot machines into New Orleans, could have learned what Kilgallen was going to publish in her book and let his mafia buddies know, and they in turn contacted Paddocky and put the squeeze on him as described before. Thus, Farber is an important link in the chain leading to Kilgallen's death. If, in fact, she told Farber about her investigations of both the JFK assassination and Marilyn's mysterious death based on the columns she wrote, then there does exist another definite connection between the two women, both their life and times and their deaths. And it means that Kilgallen was not only going to print damaging evidence about Joe and Bobby Kennedy's double cross of the mafia that put the president in danger, resulting in his assassination, but also facts pointing to RFK's complicity in Marilyn's death. If this was the case, Kilgallen was dead, as the Las Vegas casino boss stated, but dead because she was about to expose evidence that would have destroyed the Kennedy family's reputation. Her work would not only have triggered a grand jury investigation of Carlos Marcello and J. Edgar Hoover and their parts in orchestrating the assassination and covering it up, it would also have pointed the authorities toward reopening Marilyn's case based on the evidence she had about RFK being involved in her death. Such a dangerous 1-2 punch would have led Kilgallen, as she told Farber, to break the real story and have the biggest scoop of the century. Interestingly enough, it appears that Mort Farber confided in his son David, who told the Daily Mail, "My father was a noted attorney, New York attorney. Among his clients was an investigative newspaper columnist named Dorothy Kilgallen. She confided in my father about stories she was about to break. The night before she died, she called my father and told him she had busted the JFK assassination. She was going to New Orleans to confirm a couple of things, but she felt it was going to be the biggest story in American history. That night, without further explanation, she died." Did the biggest story in American history pertain not only to the JFK assassination, but also Marilyn's tragic demise? The truth lies in Kilgallen's assassination investigation file, the one that went missing when she died and has never been found, despite this author's continuing efforts to find it. Could it be among the JFK assassination documents the government refuses to release to the public? Or hidden in the New York Police Department archives? Due to the file's incriminating evidence, that likelihood certainly exists. Regarding the mysterious deaths of Marilyn Monroe and Dorothy Kilgallen, and the ties that bind them to Robert Kennedy and the JFK assassination, the historically critical point of interest, significantly ignored to this day, that bears repeating in more detail is this seemingly undisputed set of facts. If Robert Kennedy's complicity in Marilyn's death, through whatever means, had been exposed, causing him to be charged in a court of law, there would have never been a JFK assassination by RFK's enemies in 1963. Bobby would have been fighting to clear his name, with all attempts to put Carlos Marcello behind bars or deport him forgotten, at least for a time, prior to November of that year. Thus, the very motive for Marcello to orchestrate JFK's demise, so Bobby would be powerless, may have very well disappeared from view. The president would not have been a sitting duck during any trip he took to Dallas and may have lived a full life, as it should have been, instead of being collateral damage to RFK's abuse of power, which led to his enemies killing the president. In turn, as noted, Dorothy Kilgallen would have had no JFK assassination to investigate based on the actions of RFK's enemies in 1963, thus preventing her from being in danger, since no book for Random House would have been in the offing naming names as to who had orchestrated the president's death. Instead of being collateral damage to Bobby's abuse of power, Kilgallen's star would have burned brightly, permitting this woman of integrity to live for many years to come.